that 28th annual longest walk from Alcatraz Island in the San Francisco Bay to Washington, D.C. I recorded him in 2006 at the Roxy, a small movie house in San Francisco's Mission District. Dennis Banks died, age 80, on October 29, 2017. He was co-founder of AIM, the American Indian Movement, and he's remembered for the 1972 Trail of Broken Treaties and the almost week-long occupation of the Bureau of Indian Affairs. Dennis Banks was also present at the occupation of Wounded Knee, and he was an author, teacher, and drug counselor, and father of many children. I'm grateful that Dennis Banks allowed me to record him in February 2006. And I hope that his understanding of walking and journey taking has meaning for you listening today. Now that Dennis Banks has begun his own journey into the spirit world. I'm recording this on October 31st, 2017. Dennis Banks' family has stated that he will be buried in Leech Lake, Minnesota, with traditional services. You can hear this recording again and pass it on freely to others by visiting the website of TUC Radio at tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under newest programs or podcasts. TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz on the Doctrine of Discovery. In 1455, Pope Nicholas V issued to the King of Portugal the Bull Romanus Pontifex. It was sanctioning and promoting the conquest, colonization, and exploitation of non-Christian nations and their lands. This became the Doctrine of Discovery, that amazingly is still enforced today. Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz explains in this part one of three programs that is based on a talk she gave at the Lannan Foundation. The Lannan Foundation in Santa Fe, apart from awarding grants, presents speakers of extraordinary intellect and passion. Among them, just in 2017, Terry Tempest Williams, Glenn Greenwald, and Arundhati Roy. Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz spoke on October 11, 2017. You may remember her from a TUC radio program on the release of her groundbreaking book, An Indigenous People's History of the United States. She was introduced by Nick Estes. He's a member of the Lower Brule Sioux tribe in South Dakota, and historian and doctoral candidate in American Studies at the University of New Mexico. Here is Nick Estes.
Hamatakiapi, Nape Chuzapi, Chante, Washte. I greet each and one of you as a relative with a handshake and an open heart and mind. As a Lakota person who is a guest in this place, I'd like to recognize the land belonging to the original people. This place is known to the Tewa-speaking people in their language as Oga Poega, the white shell water place. Here, a sacred hot spring existed, a Pueblo holy site, that Spanish settlers destroyed to erect the Cathedral Basilica of St. Francis of Assisi. But Pueblo people, remember, this is their land, and so must we. There is no greater honor for a young Native historian such as myself than to introduce a respected elder of our movement and an elder to our craft. Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz is both historian and history maker, a rare position for a profession in this country that prides itself on detached objectivity and self-censorship. An all-sides-matter narrative and historical revisionism are not ideas unique to this particular political moment, but have been the hallmarks of a profession that often repeats the stories the United States likes to tell itself. That this is the greatest country in the history of the world, that it is the greatest democracy the world has ever seen, and that even if some mistakes were made, overall, it is striving toward a more perfect union. And given time, the wrinkles will work themselves out. Such statements are pure American exceptionalism. Roxanne has pushed me and countless scholars and activists of my generation and her own to study the United States, not from the vantage point of a U.S. citizen, but from the vantage point of the rest of the world. Exactly how does the rest of the world, the darker and the poorer nations, view the United States? In her many books, Roxanne has consistently asked us to turn to the first peoples of this land who have had their most intimate relationship with this settler nation. The fledgling 13 British colonies hugging the Atlantic coast in 1776, after all, didn't rapidly expand and annex billions of acres of indigenous lands and hundreds of indigenous nations in less than a century by pure accident. This rapid expansion and the annihilation of indigenous peoples was not the result of a cultural misunderstanding or a clash of cultures, as many mainstream historians would have us believe. And it wasn't because white people innately hated Indians that they decided to take their land, wantonly slaughter them, take away their political authority, confine them to concentration camps called reservations, and reduce them to paupers in their own homelands. Nor were such projects passively accepted by indigenous peoples. Roxanne reminds us such arguments ignore fundamental historical processes. We only need to look at this nation's founding document for answers. While we are taught to revere the line, "All men were created equal" in the Declaration of Independence, we don't pay much attention to the rest of the text. Several paragraphs down, its primary author, Thomas Jefferson, wrote, "King George, quote, has excited domestic insurrections, or slave revolts, amongst us, and has endeavored to bring on the inhabitants of our frontiers the merciless Indian savages," end quote. The life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness promised to early settlers and their descendants meant securing, with horrific violence, the ownership of stolen Africans brought to this continent in chains and the ownership of indigenous lands. Put simply, the world's greatest democracy was not founded on superior democratic ideals, but rather on wealth extracted from stolen labor and stolen land. In this way, the Declaration reads more like a manifesto for settler colonialism and not equality. So settler colonialism, as Roxanne points out in her latest book, Indigenous Peoples' History of the United States, is the process by which an imperial power seizes native land, eliminates the original population by force and removal, or genocide, and resettles the land with a foreign invading population. For the United States, the removal of indigenous peoples coincided with the expansion of the institution of slavery. So we shouldn't be surprised when last August, white supremacists rallied at a statue of Thomas Jefferson chanting the Nazi slogan, "Blood and Soil," at a university Jefferson founded in Charlottesville, Virginia. Richard Spencer, a founder of the alt-right, wasn't confused about Jefferson's brutal legacy, but identified the founding father as a heroic white supremacist, a slave owner, and an Indian killer. And history will judge them for it. Perhaps the United States is exceptional in this regard for its view of history. When asked about the American Indian Movement's occupation of Wounded Knee in 1973, James Baldwin told an interviewer, quote, "Americans have no attitude toward history at all. Because, in fact, the whole achievement of being American is the attempt to destroy history. It does not exist. They don't know they have to pay for their history, because the Indians have paid for it every inch and every hour," end quote. Perhaps if New Mexicans took seriously the history Roxanne describes in her book, Roots of Resistance, A History of Land Tenure in New Mexico, they would understand that it was a broad alliance between Native and Genisaros, those of mixed Spanish and Native ancestry, that expelled Spanish overlords. Perhaps if books like Roxanne's An Indigenous People's History of the United States were read widely in classrooms, we'd understand the interlocking systems of oppression arising from settler colonialism, the legacies of slavery and indigenous genocide. And perhaps if we read Roxanne's edited collection of oral history of Lakota elders and freedom fighters and the great Sioux Nation sitting in judgment on America, we'd understand that the heroic struggle of the Ocheti Shalkowy to halt the Dakota Access Pipeline was part of a long tradition of indigenous resistance, and that the 19th century Indian Wars are far from over. And unfortunately, Roxanne's forthcoming book, Loaded, A Disarming History of the Second Amendment, will continue to be relevant as long as homicidal white masculinity is culturally and legally mandated in this country. From the first time I met Roxanne, we have talked about Amilcar Cabral's concept of return to the source of oppression and resistance. For these settler states of America, it is settler colonialism. Those who have thwarted the finality of settlement in the United States have been indigenous peoples. Roxanne instructs us that history and resistance are two pillars of liberation. The terms of history in this way are not hashed out in dusty archives or in academic debate alone. As we see in St. Louis right now, or at Standing Rock, or right here in this colonial settlement called Santa Fe, history is an active element of our current moment being fought for in the streets and primarily led by indigenous and black people. Roxanne has been a comrade in that struggle, and we are the product of that work. People have given their lives or currently sit behind bars, such as Leonard Peltier, for us to be here today. So what are the stakes of history? It is to say, as Roxanne and those like her have been saying for more than five centuries, colonialism and capitalism are not naturally occurring systems, nor are the ills that they bring, such as slavery, genocide, imperialism, racism, heteropatriarchy, and white supremacy. So we should be turning to those indigenous societies who have resisted colonialism and capitalism for centuries to imagine a world otherwise, because the mandate is to return to the source, as Roxanne constantly reminds me. We are the source, we are the past, and we are the future. And so with that is my great honor and privilege to welcome my comrade, my relative and elder, Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz.
I'm really happy to be here in this beautiful theater and thank all of you for being here. And especially, I thank Nick for his very kind remarks and the fact that he's a very essential part of this talk tonight. I want to acknowledge that we are present on the unceded traditional territory, the Tewa people's towns and farms, which were brutally invaded and occupied, the people's lives disrupted and displaced in 1607, 410 years ago, when the Spanish established their first proclaimed center of dominance in this area. This is also the central site of perhaps the most important liberation movement and revolution in North America, if not the world. This was the 1680 All-Indian Pueblo Revolution, which occurred a century before the future and present colonizer, the United States of America, even existed. That revolutionary spirit is the primary means by which the indigenous peoples of New Mexico, and actually the whole Southwest, have continued through the past three centuries, and they are the future of this place. I want to say a few words about that 12-year revolution of the 1680s. As a doctoral student in history at UCLA in 1974, I wrote my dissertation on the history of land tenure in New Mexico from pre-colonial times to the present, which became my book, Roots of Resistance, and the template for my research and writing on settler colonialism and its inseparable offspring, attempted genocide. So I owe much to the people and the place that we are in. The Pueblo Revolution brought the Spanish colony to a quick end in 1680. Some years, at least 20, perhaps much longer, of organization produced a unified offensive on the part of all but a few southern pueblos. Remember, there were dozens and dozens of pueblos then, not 19 or 21. There were 90 at first. They were reduced in population and numbers during Spanish colonization. But this unified offensive of the pueblos included the Hopi, of course, and the Zuni to the west, as well as Apache, Navajo, and Ute allies. Many low in the Spanish caste hierarchy, African, mestizo, and indigenous servants living in the servant sector of the Santa Fe Barrio del Anaco joined the revolt. The entire population of settlers, priests, and military were forced into exile to El Paso, where they planned a return, which took place again violently in 1692. And as you know, this is called La Entrada. And it is officially celebrated right here in Santa Fe, and there are monuments and plaques that present the people who conquered once again as heroes. So why did the Spanish colonizers believe they had the right to appropriate the lands of peoples over 5,000 miles and across a great ocean from Spain? Indeed, how did the British, first as colonizers along the Atlantic shore, then as Anglo-Americans forming their own empire from sea to shining sea? And why is this a continuing current event and not just history? This brings me to the doctrine of discovery. In 1982, the government of Spain and the Holy See, that's the Vatican, which is a non-voting state member of the United Nations, so that's a state that's 1 square mile with no population. So if you wonder why a native nation can be a member of the United Nations, just look at the Vatican. Why not? So the Spain and Holy See, proposed to the United Nations General Assembly that the year 1992 be celebrated in the United Nations as an encounter, an encuentro, between Europe and the indigenous peoples of the Americas, a commemoration that would honor Europeans for having brought the gifts of civilization and Christianity to the peoples of the Western Hemisphere. But then all of the African diplomats scattered around the meeting room, seated in alphabetical order by their nation's names, rose in unison. So in other words, of course, they're all black, African, and it was just amazing. I don't know how they communicated, but they did in that 5 minutes or so. And they all rose up at one time and walked out. And the befuddled Europeans and Euro-Americans looked around at each other in confusion. A recess was declared. An hour later, the meeting reconvened. And the African group's chosen spokesperson delivered an impassioned statement condemning any proposal that would celebrate the onset of European colonialism, genocide, and the transatlantic slave trade in the halls of the United Nations. Which was established, as they pointed out, for the purpose of decolonization. So the doctrine of discovery had reared its head in the wrong place. But it was not the end of efforts by Spain. And remember, this is not fascist Franco Spain. This is democratic socialist party Spain. The Vatican and others in the West, particularly the Reagan-Bush administrations, to make the quincentennial a cause for celebration. But it was a failed endeavor, ultimately, thanks to the powerful solidarity of the world's indigenous and oppressed peoples, along with growing European and Euro-American allies. So as I said, only 5 years before the incident in the UN General Assembly, the Indigenous Peoples of the Americas Conference at the United Nations Geneva, Switzerland headquarters had proposed that 1992 be designated as the United Nations Year of Mourning for the onset of colonialism, African slavery, and attempted genocide of the Indigenous Peoples of the Americas. However, that year's Nobel Peace Prize was bestowed upon Guatemalan K'iche Mayan leader Rigoberta Menchú. And it was announced in Oslo on October 12, 1992. A decision that infuriated the Spanish government and the Vatican, who withdrew their ambassadors for a time. And in Rigoberta's speech at the Nobel ceremony accepting the prize, she accepted it not for herself, but on behalf of the world's indigenous peoples. So what is the doctrine of discovery? According to this medieval canon law, European Christian monarchies acquired title to the lands they discovered, and indigenous inhabitants lost their natural right to that land after Christian Europeans had arrived and claimed it. Under this legalistic cover for theft, European and Euro-American wars of conquest and settler colonialism in the Western Hemisphere devastated indigenous nations and communities, ripping their territories away from them and transforming the land into private property or real estate, along with another form of private property, enslaved African bodies. In the United States, most of that land ended up in the hands of land speculators, who were also slavers and agribusiness operators, called plantations, such as most of the U.S. founding fathers, so-called, and most of the U.S. presidents and other government and military officials up to the Civil War. Arcane as it may seem, the doctrine of discovery remains the basis for U.S. federal laws still in effect that control indigenous people's lives and destinies. So from the mid-15th century to the mid-20th century, most of the non-European world was colonized under the doctrine of discovery. It originated in a papal bull issued in 1455 that permitted the Portuguese monarchy to seize West Africa for slave raiding. Following Columbus's infamous exploratory voyage in 1492, sponsored by the king and queen of the infant Spanish state, another papal bull extended similar permission to Spain. Disputes between the Portuguese and Spanish monarchies led to the papal-initiated Treaty of Tordesillas in 1494, which, besides dividing the globe equally between the two Iberian empires, clarified that only non-Christian lands fell under the discovery doctrine. So this doctrine, on which all European states relied, was later seized and absorbed by Protestant, Christian, European, monarchical colonizing projects as well, but not only monarchies. Following the revolution that overthrew the monarchy, the French Republic applied the doctrine of discovery to legalize its 19th and 20th century settler colonialist projects in North Africa, Southeast Asia, and the South Pacific, as did the anti-monarchy independent United States when it continued the settler colonial project of North America, begun but then halted by the British monarchy in 1754. Indeed, the populist settler colonialism of those republics, as well as the late Spanish settler colonies, Argentina, Uruguay, Paraguay, and Chile, when they won independence and became republics, proved to be the most insidious, including genocidal policies which in terms of the 1948 Genocide Convention includes forcibly removing children from the group, forcibly preventing births within the group, creating conditions of life that make the group's continued existence impossible, destroying the group's means of subsistence, forced removals or ethnic cleansing, and other acts such as killing that constitute genocide in international law. Indicating the intentions of the newly independent United States, in 1792, Secretary of State Thomas Jefferson asserted that the doctrine of discovery developed by European states was international law, applicable to the new U.S. government as well. Codifying the doctrine of discovery as domestic law in 1823, the U.S. Supreme Court issued a decision, actually a collection of decisions, three decisions concerning the Cherokee Nation in Georgia. Writing for the majority, Chief Justice John Marshall held that the doctrine of discovery had been an established principle of European law and of English law in effect in British North American colonies and was also the law of the United States. The court defined the exclusive property rights that a European country acquired by dint of discovery. Quote, Marshall writing, "Discovery gave title to the United States government, by whose subjects or by whose authority it was made, against all other European governments, which title might be consummated by possession." Therefore, European and Euro-American discoverers had gained real property rights in the lands of indigenous peoples by merely planting a flag. Of course, they were and still are met with resistance by the peoples whose land they claim. The court held that the indigenous rights to complete sovereignty, and quote, as independent nations were necessarily diminished. Indigenous peoples could continue to live on the land by grace of the federal government, but title resided with the United States Republic. And of course, this came to be called trust, or the trust doctrine, which still exists. Soon it turned out that the indigenous people in question who brought the cases to the Supreme Court, the Cherokee Nation and the state of Georgia, were not allowed to remain in their ancestral territory. And Cherokee citizens were forced to march 1,500 miles on foot through an abnormally cold winter, during which half their number died of exposure, starvation, and disease, what the Cherokee people call to this day the Trail of Tears. Already the Muscogee peoples had been deported from Alabama and Mississippi, and by 1850, all the other indigenous peoples east of the Mississippi had been forcibly relocated to Indian Territory west of the Mississippi, which comprised what is now Oklahoma, all of Oklahoma, and part of Kansas and Arkansas. Parallel to and enabled by this ethnic cleansing was the rise of the Cotton Kingdom in the Mississippi Valley and the industrial forced breeding of enslaved Africans in the older slaver states, the foundation and birth of United States capitalism, burrowed into and destroying indigenous sacred land and African sacred bodies as exchange commodities and the source of wealth that built the richest nation, state, and largest and deadliest military in human history, the United States of America. So the doctrine of discovery, at least in the United States, is so taken for granted that very few people even know it exists as a fundamental element of United States law. Yet the doctrine of discovery is the legal basis upon which the United States government controls indigenous nations.
That was historian and author Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz on the doctrine of discovery. She spoke at the Lannan Foundation in Santa Fe on October 11, 2017. Her upcoming book is Loaded, a Disarming History of the Second Amendment, to be published by City Lights in 2018. Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz has been part of the international indigenous movement for more than four decades, working on sovereignty and land rights. Thanks to the Lannan Foundation for permission to use the audio from the video they produced of the 1.5-hour event. You can watch the film at their website at lannan.org. Come back for two more segments with Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz and Nick Estes when TUC Radio returns. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.
And you're tuned to Community Radio KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. On the web at kboo.fm. This program is made possible in part by KBOO members and a support from the Garden Spout, specializing in indoor gardening equipment, including horticultural lighting, environmental control, hydroponic and organic nutrients, and pest control. The Garden Spout is located at 4532 Southeast 63rd, just south of Foster in Portland. Information at 503-788-GROW. And Portland Saturday Market, open daily December 16th through December 24th for the Festival of the Last Minute. Saturday Market offers handmade art, crafts, and other gifts created by artists from the Pacific Northwest and is located at 2 Southwest Ankeny in Waterfront Park. Information at PortlandSaturdayMarket.com.